phrases on every distant shore. But so few remember what he was fighting for. Oh, I sing the songs and forget about the aim. He wrote them for a reason, why not sing them for the same? For now he's bound for a glory all his own. And now he's bound for glory.
Welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, with Ryan Gable. It's August 30th, and that was Phil Oakes singing, well, really about Woody Guthrie, but it's about any free soul fighting to take back the earth for all the people. And this show is dedicated to all of you out there who are not just talking, but doing. We're here every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, and you can follow our work at kanatarepublic.ca. That Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, means our village in the Haudenosaunee language, kanatarepublic.ca. And Ryan and I today are going to continue our discussion with some interesting updates that happened this last week. I wanted to share a few of these with you because it's certainly relevant to what we're going to be talking about today. There was a notice in the Vancouver Sun newspaper, and it said that all the doctors in Canada under the Canadian Medical Association and the school boards are now unanimous in demanding that the government bring in a new policy that no child can enroll in a school, whether it's elementary or secondary, unless they've been vaccinated. That's right. Mandatory vaccination for any school child in Canada now. Apparently, they've started this in California, and now it's worked up to Canada. And that's a flag for people out there who think that somehow you can use the system and not be affected by it. Another argument to homeschool your kids, people. Another news item is, and guess what? Another convenient death happened. You might have remembered this fellow, Joseph Wesolowski. He was a archbishop, actually a cardinal, eventually. He was the papal nuncio to the Dominican Republic. So this is a Vatican ambassador. And he was caught not just molesting kids, but organizing child trafficking all through Central America for the Roman Catholic Church. Now, Joseph Wesolowski was being used as a test case because Jorge Bergoglio, the present pope, so-called pope, he's said that, well, we're going to take matters into our own hands. We're going to set up Vatican courts to try our own people, kind of like the mob looking into their own crimes. But anyway, Joseph Wesolowski was to be the test case. He was going to stand trial in a Vatican court. Now he's dead a couple of weeks before the trial was supposed to begin. What I find interesting is that Wesolowski was tied into the diplomatic corps, and we know that the child trafficking involves a lot of diplomats and politicians around the world, so perhaps somebody didn't want Joseph Wesolowski to sing like a canary in court. And that's a fitting end to a child rapist, but maybe not so fitting. It would have been nice to see the guy on public trial. And leading into the next point, and then I'll bring Ryan on for his comments and thoughts about all of this, we are going to continue in our discussion of the Pope's upcoming visit to America. August 22nd is when he arrives, touches down at Andrews Air Force Base in Washington, D.C., and has a little tete-a-tete with Obama, President Obama. But before he goes to address the Congress the next day, he's going to canonize, a funny term, making somebody a saint, canonize a guy called Junipero Serra, who was a murderous Franciscan missionary who organized slave plantations in California where many thousands of Indians were worked to death. Well, apparently that qualifies you for becoming a saint in the Catholic Church. As a matter of fact, the present pope said the other day, quote, "We are inspired by his zeal," unquote. So I guess Jorge Bergoglio is very zealous for people who murder Indians who refuse to become Catholics. Anyway, so what we learned this week is that Native groups in America are finally taking action, and they are planning to rally outside the church when he's canonizing Junipero Serra. Now, we posted all the dates of his appearances and all the protest actions being planned, September 22nd right through to the 27th, when Bergoglio is in America. But please note this one action we do know is confirmed now. Wednesday, September 23rd in Washington, D.C. at 4 p.m., the canonization ceremony is going to be held at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. whatever the hell that means. And at the Basilica at 4 p.m. on the 23rd of September, there will be native groups both outside and inside the ceremony, apparently. It looks like they're going to do what we did in Vancouver when we invaded the Catholic Church. And one of the native groups doing this, and they're coming out with their own media statement soon, but they announced that they do not want the Catholic Church anywhere on their territory anymore, which probably includes most of course, continental America. So that should be an interesting development on that day. So please flag that and see ITCCS.org, the latest posting for these and other important protest dates. Final point about that, too, of course, spiritual elders will be conducting exorcism and ceremonies at these church events. For example, when the Pope is giving a mass in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, there'll be a group there. Madison Square Gardens, where he's doing a mass, and Ground Zero, 9/11 site, there will always be counter services going on according to the plan in the works. So anyway, that's all really exciting, and I hope you spread the word and get people to listen to this show for and previous shows archived at bbsradio.com/Radio Free Canada. Okay, Ryan, welcome again.
Hey, Kevin, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. And
I am really glad to see that there is a building resistance against Bergoglio's visit to the United States. I think that's a really positive and good thing for the movement.
Yes, it's excellent. It's a long time coming, and I think people have reached their saturation point when it comes to these Vatican crimes. Because I've been getting indications all over that people on their own are taking our information and running with it. It may not be done under our umbrella. It doesn't really matter as long as people are taking the action and using this information.
That's exactly right. And one of the first things you brought up today was about the vaccinations and how the vaccinations that were made mandatory in California, now it seems to have inadvertently spread, ironically, as if it was a virus or a disease, up into Canada, and now all of Canada is being kind of prepped for mandatory vaccinations as well. It touches on a theme, a very common theme that we discuss often on the program, and that is that you can see these agendas being rolled out historically and in the present day, both in the United States, Canada, Britain, and all across the world at the same time, proving that there is an underlying agenda in the works by a small group of individuals who have a plan in place for us as human beings. Obviously, it's not a coincidence that the very month, basically, that California, and it's not going to start until next year, but the month that the Californians actually, they passed the Senate Bill 277 to make vaccines mandatory for all children. They start talking about making vaccines mandatory for all adults. Then the governor of California, Jerry Brown, goes and he gets invited to some Vatican conference where he goes and starts yelling about climate change and how we need to control the population. And then all of a sudden, just coincidentally, the Canadians start calling for forced vaccinations as well. It's obviously a plan, Kevin. That's my thought. What are your thoughts?
Well, definitely. And as well as that, of course, under this system, you've got to follow the money. We remember in the swine flu snafu a few years ago, a year after there was big hysteria and the governments were insisting that everyone's going to die unless they get this swine flu vaccine, one of the top researchers for, I'm trying to remember which big pharma company it was, he came out and he was jokingly referring to their angst campaign, which was completely as a way to raise their revenue. They made $11.5 billion out of that scare. And as it turns out, less than half of the people came down with it who even normally come down with flu. So it was a big lie conducted by the government in their pay and the big pharma companies. Now, of course, the Vatican is a heavy investor in big pharma. And, it all ties together. But don't forget, there's a huge profit motive involved in this as well.
Well, absolutely. The money is absolutely the source of all of this evil, if you will. But I think at the root, you also find that vaccinations have historically been used for purposes of mass cultural genocide against native populations. And I think that that's a very, very important aspect of this agenda to flag and to understand historically, because whether it's the T4 vaccinations in Germany, or the Sterilization Act of British Columbia in 1933, the same year the Germans passed their Sterilization Act, or, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago on the program, here in the United States, we had vaccination programs to eliminate political dissidents and people that were considered mentally ill, i.e. they rebelled against the state. And this was in like 1910, 1911, something along those lines. So this was a long time ago that these vaccination programs were being run for genocidal purposes. But obviously, yes, it does come down to money.
Now, you know, you mentioned British Columbia, and it's interesting because the West Coast, I was kind of placed there providentially, I think, because the West Coast of North America is traditionally a hotbed for a lot of this stuff. For one thing, a lot of these villages are isolated, and they can experiment on the native population, and nobody ever finds out this stuff. But still, a lot of the missing Aboriginal women disappear in these parts of the world. Let me give you a few quotes from some of the founders of British Columbia. There's this guy, Edward Bulwer Lytton. He was the first speaker of the Legislative Assembly in British Columbia. He wrote a book called The Coming Race in 1868. He said, quote, "Colonization is civilization. If we, the superior race, take the land of other races, we must utterly destroy the previous inhabitants," unquote. And people say Canada wasn't built on genocide. Here's another one. I'll hit you with another one here. Premier Frederick Seymour. Now, all of these guys, they have streets named after them in Vancouver. Premier Frederick Seymour in 1868, premier of the province, said, "I may have to employ the Colorado solution and order every white man to kill every Indian in this province," unquote. It goes on and on. You won't see those quotes in the history books, though. But
no,
you can
absolutely
find them in hiddennolonger.com, by the way, folks. Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, what I was going to say is that in terms of genocide in Canada or in America, obviously most people don't really understand, as you mentioned a couple of months ago in the program, what the word genocide actually means. Mm-hmm. And obviously there are other vehicles through forms of eugenics to create a master race. Where did this idea actually come from, to your understanding, Kevin? Because a lot of people think it was just Nazi Germany, the master race, the Aryan Ubermen or the Supermen. Where did this actually come from? Because this seems much older than 1933.
Very old. And, you know, it's articulated most clearly in the records of the early Roman Catholic Church. But I'll just before that, the word itself, As people can learn by going to hiddennolonger.com, in my book, Hidden No Longer, Genocide in Canada, Past and Present, the word was coined by a guy called Raphael Lemkin, and he was a refugee from Eastern Europe, worked for the U.S. War Department. He wrote a book called Axis Rule in Occupied Europe, and published in 1944, and he's the first one publicly who used this word genocide. Now, genos in Greek means a people, like a whole people, and side, C-I-D, means kill. So it literally means to kill a whole people. And Lemkin had a very broad definition, and this is very important to remember. He said anything you do to disrupt the normal life of a people and create long-term conditions where they're going to die off, that's genocide. Now, if you isolate boys and girls from the same group at a young age, break up families, don't let people speak their language, put them in special schools where they're brainwashed, that's as much genocide as lining them up against a wall and shooting them and dumping them in a ditch. He said there was physical, biological, and cultural genocide, each one of them just as serious. So it's kind of funny when the Canadian government comes out, and this was quoted in the New York Times June 3rd, finally made the international press, the head of the Supreme Court in Canada, Beverly McLaughlin, says, yes, cultural genocide occurred. You know, as if there weren't 50,000 dead kids, just somehow, you know, we deny them their language. What Beverly doesn't mention is the fact that that's as serious as an admission as if she said, yes, we killed all of them. But there's no consequence because they're still in charge. But the point is that this word is used, bandied around, without any discussion of, well, what's the consequence? I mean, you kill off tens of thousands of children and nobody's even been to trial for it. I mean, it boggles the mind. It's often said, you know, it takes only one person to commit a crime, but a whole community to cover it up. That's what we're seeing. And the language is very important, too, because now even at the UN, they don't use the word genocide much anymore. They talk about ethnic cleansing, other terms to kind of, you know, like we've talked about before, it makes a horror very benign. depending on the kind of words you use to describe it.
Right. Well, the system is very, very careful now, the words that they do use to describe it. And even when using a term such as genocide, it's been so sterilized that it doesn't mean what it originally meant. So that in that way, they can kind of get away perceptually to the public with committing that act. But people really don't understand what the original definition was, as you explained, Raphael Lemkin, when he first defined it. And obviously, nowadays, people have a very sterilized, whitewashed version of what the term means. And, you know, you said that natives were basically abused for speaking their own language. They, as you know, you might read, had the Indian beaten out of them. And I know that's a very violent, overt, physical, in-your-face kind of approach to performing these acts in order to get someone to stop speaking their own language, to eradicate their culture. But I see this now in America, Kevin. I don't know how much this goes on in Canada, but we've got professors at Yale University saying that the word master is a racist word, it's offensive, don't use it. We have the New Hampshire University school coming out with a language guide. They say that you can't use the word American anymore, it's offensive. You can't say obese, you can't say mother and father. There's actually a school here in the United States that tells parents not to refer to other children as boys or girls, but to actually call them purple penguins. I know that sounds really crazy. Yeah, exactly. It sounds really crazy. But to me, that is a cultural form of genocide because we're preventing right. people from using their language, and it's really breaking society apart and fracturing it on top of the antisocial behavior bred from social media. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it goes back to what I was going to talk about too, which is the origin of a lot of this. And, you know, the 20th century term, that's, you know, the words follow the reality. I mean, genocide's been going on for millennia, but there was this term in the 20th century crafted called corporatism. And it came out of really fascist Italy, which reestablished the Vatican in 1929 after it was disestablished by Garibaldi in 1870. The Vatican Bank and the Vatican as a, quote, state was created by Mussolini deliberately as kind of a corporatist model of the future. Now, this corporatist model has spread everywhere in the world. We now live under a global corporatocracy. We don't live in a, quote, democratic or any kind of accountable system anymore of governments and all that. That's just window dressing. The corporatocracy that exists, as you mentioned, has to break apart all the normal human relationships in order to integrate everybody directly into a corporate state where they have no identity except as a component in a machine. And it's that simple. Now, spiritually and psychically, what goes along with that is there have to be techniques brought in at a very young age, mostly through trauma-based conditioning and fear, whereby nobody is able to critically think anymore. And there, you know, a lot of the experiments that went on in the Indian schools and hospitals that we've documented were all geared towards that. I'm looking at some notes I made when we were doing our first investigation at the Nanaimo Indian Hospital. We brought in a trained police psychic and gave her some of the documents and everything. And she clearly found stuff that was agreeing with a lot of the documents. She never even looked at this stuff, and yet she was referring to experiments being done on Indian children in the 1950s, which, of course, was the high point of a lot of this MKUltra research in that. And it was designed to, they would shove probes through the nasal cavities into the base of the brain to separate the frontal part of the brain from the midsection. Now, what that does is, like a lobotomy, it incapacitates the normal emotional responses and the ability to critically think. It immobilizes a person mentally, yet allows them to continue to function. So, in effect, they're walking robots. And she, Yvonne, who was the psychic, gave a very thorough description of some of these kids, how they were trained as docile servants and then sent over to England to be, you know, used in that way. So, I mean, these early experiments are designed to do something which chemically happens now through drugs like chlorpromazine, which I believe was introduced in the water systems in North America for a number of years, and it creates what Dr. Ruth Kayander, the Nazi scientist who developed this drug, she referred to it as creating a state of mental disinterest without loss of consciousness. Now, in other words, you look around today, And you look at the way people are, and that's exactly the condition they're in. They appear to be awake, but they don't have any critical analytical ability, and no, and this is the important part, they can't act on what they know. They're frozen.
It's like it's psychologically impossible for them to make a decision to act.
Exactly, and that isn't just because of apathy. It isn't because of any of the normal excuses we have. You know, there's a whole other component going on. And the whole question now is, well, if we really are in that dire state, what can be done? The reality is that not all of us are affected by it. And that's where, for me, the spiritual element comes in, because we are, and I learned from my own work, we have protection when we are aware of this and we are trying to disengage humanity from the system that's crippling them in that way. So I want to, you know, in the latter half of the show, I want to talk about that, how we're doing that.
Great. We've got a couple of minutes, about five before break.
Okay.
But I wanted to play on what you said there. There's a quote from the famous eugenicist Bertrand Russell. I don't have it in front of me, but I'll just kind of give you a paraphrase. He talked about in the future how we will have vaccinations and how food and injunctions will lead to creating a population that will be raised and bred in order to follow not just state doctrine, but the ways in which children are taught and brought up. It will literally make it, quote, psychologically impossible, end quote, for children to understand what's going on and to grow up and be able to fight back against the system. And obviously, as he said, it's not just done through vaccines, it's also done through food. It's also done through other avenues. And if you look, as you mentioned, the water supply, not just hydrofluorosilicic acid, not just lithium in the water, and a bunch of other additives that are purposely put in there, but you even have a byproduct of the medical industry with pharmaceutical drugs that are dumped into the water, or human waste that isn't properly filtered out, and that gets back into the water supply. So we are mass medicated. It's like a global lobotomy for a mass majority of the population, simply as a byproduct of industry and also as part of a genocidal agenda, in my opinion. What are your thoughts, Kevin?
Well, yeah, and there was a news item years ago in the Vancouver newspapers that said there's so much Prozac in the water because everyone is so drugged out on Prozac, and when they urinate, it enters into the water system, so everyone's getting drugged out. I mean, it's that simple.
Nowadays we have kids on so many different types of psychotropic drugs, and you look at some of the mass shooters that you hear about in the news, that they use these instances, play on people's heartstrings because of the children who died, and then they use that to try to take away people's guns. Regardless of that political argument, look at all of the shooters. Every single shooter was on some type of psychotropic, psychoactive drug, which on the websites of most of the drugs says will lead to violent outbursts. And most of the drugs that you take, you'll commit acts of violence, you'll hurt yourself, you'll hurt others, and not even remember that you did it. It creates a type of violent population who has no recollection and no empathy for anybody or anything, and that further debilitates the ability of the people to stand up and psychologically assess and be able to make a decision about how they want to stand up and fight back against what's enslaving them. Better yet, they don't even know what's enslaving them. They think they're free because the prison wall is built just far enough so that they can't see it.
Right. Now, we're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a short break and listen to some interesting things. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about what we can do, how we fight back spiritually, and more stuff related to that. So we'll be back in a minute. That was Bella Ciao. Now, I thought that was a very important piece to play because it actually was written by people in the Italian resistance during World War II. And it's had a lot of different variations of it. You can find it all over a YouTube search. But it speaks to me about how we need to inspire one another now. I mean, you think of what the human race has been through and the kind of tyranny they've had to fight and have overcome. Where our backs are to the wall, people, and we have to bring down the system now. It's a matter of survival for all of us, as we've been talking about. So anyway, that's for our mutual inspiration. And to continue on, Ryan, I wanted to just mention something before we go into the question of what we do and how we do it. We talked about indigenous people and why they've been targeted over the centuries and the millennia for genocide. For me, it has to do with the fact that, and I don't want to romanticize natives because I've worked with so many of them and I understand how messed up their culture is as much as ours is, but the reality is that all of us were once indigenous and we had an inherent tie to Mother Earth and to the hidden secrets and power there. And we have to, part of the global lobotomization you're talking about is cutting us off from those natural sources of strength and awareness. And that's why indigenous culture, all of our indigenous people, our own ancestors, were targeted by the same corporatist system. You know, all filth, all crime leads to Rome. This is where it started and where it continues out of. So just, you know, your thoughts about that and how it goes to the next step of what we are going to do now.
Yeah, what do you think the first step is in terms of a spiritual awakening? I mean, personally, I think non-compliance would be the best first step. We just simply stop complying with the system the way that it is.
Well, yeah, in terms of at the level of doing, absolutely right. But I find that with people, especially in the state we're in right now, what has to precede the doing is the being. It's really a question of who are we, not so much what do we do, because what do we do is putting the cart before the horse. We've tried this over the last year and a half with the Republic of Kanata. We've had all sorts of ideas about what people we should do, but they don't do it because there's an inner captivity that they haven't broken from. There's fear. The first question they have is, well, am I going to get in trouble if I do this? That's not how a free mind acts and thinks. So we have to break the inner chains first. And so in terms of the being, I'm inspired by, you know, and it's, I think what's in you know, when I was training as a minister, I was always saying this in seminary. I said, what Jesus is talking about is far more important than religion. It's too important for religion. It speaks to all of us, regardless of what you call yourself. And in his time and again, except in the Gospel of John, which was fabricated about 100 years after the guy, and significantly, the Church of Rome always quotes from the Gospel of John, which talks about Jesus as this divine being. It's all about I am the way, the vine, the truth. You know, it's all about him. In fact, in the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, what they call the Synoptic Gospels, they were written much closer in time to Jesus, just within about 20 or 30 years after he was alive. And the message in there, time and again, is not about him at all. It's about this thing he calls the kingdom of heaven, which is, again, an English translation from the Greek basilei tautheo, which means fortress of God. If you go to the Aramaic, which is the language he spoke in, the word actually means realm of eternity. And this realm of eternity he was always talking about, he said, and this is really key to everything I think we're talking about, two things. He said, my kingdom is not of this world, which kind of invalidates religion right there. I mean, if it's not of this world, why are there churches? Why is there a Vatican bank, right? But he said, it's not of this world, and he also said, it is within you. Remember, the kingdom of heaven is within you, but the word in Greek doesn't just mean within. That's how we've misinterpreted kind of New Age thinking, well, it's all about my personal spiritual growth. It also, besides within, means among. It's the same word, within you and among you, right? So this realm of eternity is already present among us here in the world and in our hearts, in our soul, and yet it's not of this world. That means it's not owned by the spirit of this world. So for me, personally, it begins there, that inner recognition and collective recognition that we're not part of this. It's not like we have to break from anything. We are already not part of it. You know, the way Magna Carta described something that already was, it didn't create human rights. It recognized that these unalienable liberties are already born in us. Well, it's the same thing with this realm of eternity. It's always born in us. All we have to do is live in it. And suddenly, all the powers around us start disintegrating. And that's the, you can call it magic. You can call it the shift in she that we've talked about over the last few weeks. This reclaiming of the energy. It has to start from that new kind of being. And then it's obvious. Once that's there, it's obvious what you have to do. then you're empowered to break away and doing everything you're talking about doing. But the doing has to follow that inner kind of awakening and collective awakening that we express among all of us. Anyway, that's my take on it. What are your thoughts?
It reminds me of the comedian George Carlin when he was talking about human perceptions of rights, especially in the United States, and how we have the Bill of Rights, and we think that we're so special and these rights were given to us by God, when in reality, if you look at other nations, other countries, some countries like Germany have twice as many rights as we do. And George Carlin was saying how, what did God just make a mistake? Is he bad at arithmetic? And if you look at it from that point of view, in a comical way, and I think comedy and laughing at, like I mentioned at, you know, before the break, how some schools in Nebraska want to call kids purple penguins and no longer boys and girls, a further limiting of the language, which is a form of genocide. And you just kind of laugh at it and have a point of view that just sees this as comical, and you just walk away right. from these people that are trying to put you in chains. And you see these other countries that also have rights, but every country has a different set of rights. So it's not rights given from God. God didn't go to Germany and say, okay, you get 20 rights, and Americans, you get 10 rights, and the Canadians get the... It's not like that, and that just shows you the insanity of it. These are government... given perceptual privileges that we buy into as God-given rights through a religious belief. And deep down inside of us, we all know that what you're saying is true, Kevin. Even before I became what I am in terms of how I think, I knew that was true, but I was very much bogged down by the material world and being dragged to church and being taught the same repetitive things and the interpretation from a book from some guy who's interpreting it based on some very rigid belief system. We all know this. And if you go back to Egypt, I think it was Akhenaten actually created the first monotheistic type of religion. And when he did this, the priestly class came after him because he said that God is not out there. You don't have to go to the temples or to the churches, essentially, a more modernized version of the word, to go to God. You have God inside of you. And when he did that, the priests came after him and they basically plotted his death and killed him for, which is a very similar story, I think, in terms of Jesus, because the true teachings of Jesus, as you just mentioned, are that the kingdom of heaven is inside of you. It's nowhere else. It's not at the church. You're not going to find it anywhere else except in yourself and amongst you and others.
Right.
And I think the stories of Akhenaten and Jesus are very similar. It's kind of like an archaic storyline that's been played over many times throughout history.
Right, or what others might, or Jung or somebody might call the collective unconscious expressing itself again and
right.
again in the same story. What's interesting about the whole notion about defining a right for somebody is that the moment it's defined, it's limited, okay? It's like the Charter of Rights in Canada. It's an act of parliament or the crown. It says, you have four rights. Okay, we are giving you these four rights. And by defining it, we're restricting it. It means you can't have any other rights. Okay, the word freedom comes from a word in German, Freiheit. And a Freiheit was a right given to tenant farmers on an estate by the baron. He said, while you're, you know, slaving for me every day, I'm going to give you these rights. They're called freedoms. So even the word freedom is a way to say, some power above you is granting you a temporary privilege, okay? That has nothing to do with the inherent, well, I don't know if there is a word for it. Liberty might be closer to it. We are one. It's like God has no name. Remember in the Old Testament, he said, I am who I am? And that's what you say when you go into court. They always trap you by saying, what is your name? And don't forget, the word name comes from a Hebrew word meaning that the plaque or the sign that you hang on a slave. A name defines you as a slave of somebody else. Say, I am who I am. You can't define me. You can't give me any rights. I have them already. Go away. It's really simple once you've recovered your own soul like that, but that's the hard part. And, you know, people have such a dependency built into them. They're always looking to some expert or somebody, you know, like people continually write to me and say, what do we do next, Kevin? Like, tell us what to do. I say, people, you haven't got it yet.
You just tell people, I am what I am, or I am what is, has been, yep. and ever will be. We are all true forms of light love and consciousness, and that is all that there ever has been and ever will be.
Now, it's interesting that that message runs right through human history, and you find this interesting word called covenant in the Bible, and it's being, again, misused all the time. It's supposed to be some kind of contract. Well, the point is God and humanity can't have a contract because they're really one. And so what this idea of covenant really means is, and the early American revolutionaries used this term, standing under in the early banners, there wasn't just the snake, don't tread on me. They had another one, and it just said an appeal to heaven. And what the appeal to heaven was, it was a passage from one of the Psalms, where when the people of the Hebrew slaves, when they're wandering around trying to find a nation, they'd got out of Egyptian captivity, but they didn't have a ruler over them. The only ruler they had was God. And the appeal to heaven means you're standing only under the jurisdiction of heaven, no other jurisdiction. And that's how the early American revolutionaries saw it. We're creating something totally new on this continent. We don't have the rulers. Now, of course, there was a slave aristocracy, and, you know, the planters in Virginia and that who fought against that and eventually defeated that revolution. But that was really at the heart of the early the American Revolution, the idea there are no rulers. That we're under heaven.
What about the word heaven? Do you know where the word heaven comes from, Kevin?
I'll have to look it up. I can't remember it offhand.
I mean, I guess you could just look at this from a definitive standpoint, but if you look at the word heaven, perhaps heaven is a word like liberty that could define freedom without meaning the origins of the Germanic word of Freiheim. So maybe heaven is a form of freedom and hell is a form of servitude, but it's not necessarily, obviously, a physical place where you go when you die.
No. As a matter of fact, I mean, you know what, and it's so relevant with this whole thing of Bergoglio's visit to America. I'm constantly amazed. Like there's a newspaper in Vancouver called Common Ground, and they had a picture. I mean, this is one of these typical progressive newspapers. You know, they're against fracking, and they're in support of all the good progressive causes. And here's a picture a few weeks ago of Jorge Bergoglio on the front cover, and they're going ecstatic over Pope Francis. Why? Well, he's wearing a white robe, and he's got a nice smile. He must be a nice guy, right? They know nothing about the guy's real history and about what he's really doing now. They just need to believe that this father figure is going to save them.
Well, Kevin, and I remember when he first came on the scene, the first news story I saw was out of the New York Times, and it was about how Bergoglio went down to the hotel lobby and paid his own hotel bill, and how this was a revolutionary act, and he was such a new pope. And they use those kinds of stories to obviously defer people's attention from looking at his history.
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, you just look at what he was doing in Argentina, trafficking children, that infamous picture of him. And it's up online, itccs.org, walking hand in hand with General Videla, who was murdering thousands of people, including Bergoglio's own priests. And Bergoglio's role back then in Argentina in the 1970s was exactly what he's doing now. He was a front man and a PR guy for the Argentine junta. There had been a military coup in 1976. There were 30,000 or more people massacred, and their children were trafficked by the Catholic Church, you know, for a lot of money. And Bergoglio was going around the world saying what a great humanitarian this General Videla is. The guy has blood all over his hands, and yet none of that seems to matter because people are, psycholinguistically programmed to think, oh, Pope means Pope, Papa, Father, right? And that's their conscious mind isn't even aware of what's happening to them. That's the father figure who can't do any wrong. You know, even taking the name Francis, you know, evokes images of Francis of Assisi, you know, living in a golden palace as head of the biggest corporation on the planet is somehow something to do with Francis of Assisi, you know.
Yes, with the raising of the hand to give the blessing in the manner of being struck down if you do not be obedient.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, a lot of this is self-apparent when people have woken up, but it's that waking process which has to begin with all of us internally, and we provided more than enough knowledge and steps of what to do that. We have actually an encouraging sign from California. There's a number of cities there that are trying our model of these common law courts and people's assemblies, and in fact, starting in October, they're going to start one up in Sacramento. which is the state capital. And, you know, so this example is catching on, and it's interesting talking to the people. A lot of them are coming together now, recognizing what we're saying, and they've just been waiting for this spark. And it looks like we're helping to provide that, because we're more and more of these people are being activated now to do it. So that's really encouraging.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's great because, you know, before I met you, I had kind of had a somewhat similar attitude to what a lot of people have today coming into this information of what do we do next. And, you know, over the years, I've been able to obviously free my mind even more every day. I think I get more free in terms of the way that I think. And now I've realized, as you mentioned today, it's not about what do we do next. It's not about asking somebody, okay, what's the next part of the plan, as if we have some general or president calling all of the shots. We're all in this collectively together. You can make decisions on a local level of how to influence the world, how to influence just basic business. I mean, using your dollar, using your money to support certain companies that support your beliefs and not supporting companies that don't support your beliefs. People tend to be so overwhelmed by so many possibilities and so many options that they just go for the simplest, the easiest thing, and they don't think anything of it. And they have this mindset because they've been conditioned to believe that I'm not worth anything. I'm not going to, you know, to make anything of myself. I might as well just kind of give in. You know, who cares if they spy on me, right? I have nothing to hide. And that's a very defeatist kind of dehumanized attitude, and that's been programmed into the people. We have to realize, to first of all, that we're being controlled through these mechanisms. Genocide is an act that's being committed on the human population. It's almost as if we face a type of extinction as a species at the hands of these demons, if you will, if we could call them that. And to realize what's going on, accept it. Once we do that, Kevin, it creates a conundrum, because people either have to understand it and make a choice to do something about it, which might bring harm to them or their families, or they have to accept it, and then they have to, I guess, lose all sense of morality and ego. Yeah. And just ignore it and pretend like it doesn't exist. And people would rather do that. So instead of actually having to face either one of those issues by realizing what's going on, they just ignore when people talk to them about these issues. I mean, that's at least my take.
Yep. Tell me the time first. We got to watch the time.
Yeah. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left here, Kevin.
Okay. Well, I just, you know, kind of in closing, I want to flag this for next time, that what we're really saying is that the majority of people are caught in that, and for the next foreseeable future are not going to break from it. We're talking about a remnant. We're talking about reaching the people who are ready, who are conscious and ready to break. We can't dissipate our energy anymore addressing the multitude who are caught in this. We have to address our fellow, whatever you want to call us. I like the word remnant. It has got a lot of significance, because we are being set apart, I think, to be a seed of some new humanity. And we have to reach those people and rally them together. And once we're together, it only takes a few of us who are conscious to really make a change, because this is not about numbers. This is about, as we mentioned before, when you take back your she, a few people can evoke great change in the world, like we did in Canada over the issue of genocide, like we did when we helped force Ratzinger to resign. Truth armed with those kind of people is an unbeatable combination. And so we really have to start looking at the people around us we're able to work with and salvage right now, and not people who are going to get caught up in all these pointless dynamics of criticizing and attacking and giving reasons why things can't happen. We can't be dissipated anymore. So I would urge people, in terms of what you do, is find the few around us or around you where you live who are able to take action. That's
uniting for a common cause.
Pardon me?
Uniting for a common cause, not having to rely and wait for somebody else who sort of agrees with you to tell you what to do next,
right,
but uniting under a common cause, and everybody taking their own individual actions and responsibility for those actions for themselves. And that can make a major difference, especially at a local community level.
That's right. Now, the next show on September 6th, Sunday, we're going to be going into more of those details, upcoming events, and more reports on what's happening about Bergoglio's visit. There's also going to be actions in New York and Philadelphia, as well as D.C., so we'll keep you all posted about that, and also upcoming events in the fall. Any final words, Ryan?
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, I think it was a pretty great show. As always, Kevin, I'm glad to be here. My website is thesecretteachings.info. Tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, I'm interviewing an author named Brad Olson. We're talking about Morgellons disease, and we're going to use that topic as a springboard to get into some other current events and news. Again, that's at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, and you can find the link to the listen page at thesecretteachings.info.
Well, thanks, Ryan. It's always good to be with you. And for listeners, remember to stay tuned at kanatarepublic.ca. Go over the material there. Join up with the Republic. And also the website of the Tribunal at itccs.org. A lot of important information there. If you need to get a hold of us with program ideas or involvement or anything, write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. And until next week, all of you, stay strong and stay clear. We thank you.
Let America Be America Again by Langston Hughes. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dream.